From the Sky News Centre at 6, foreign aid is reaching Haiti, but the sheer scale of the destruction means it's still not getting through to the earthquake survivors. Millions of people have no access to food, water, shelter or electricity. Meanwhile, the search goes on for those trapped under the rubble. It's feared British UN worker Anne Barnes may be among them. Her cousin, Christine Hart from Essex, says she can only hope for the best.
She's a very strong person, so I just think that, you know, if she's somewhere where she's able to breathe and she's not badly injured, then if she'll just have the hope that somebody will find her.
A radio and TV appeal to help the victims of the Haitian earthquake airs tonight. The Disasters Emergency Committee Fund has already had more than £2 million in donations. Police have arrested a 22-year-old man after a woman was run over by a thief stealing her car. Linda Hankey from Wigan died after suffering serious head injuries. A BNP member has been jailed for 11 years after building up a cache of weapons in his bedroom. Police discovered 54 improvised explosive devices, including nail bombs, at the home of Terence Gavin, who shared it with his mother in West Yorkshire. Prince William is closer to becoming an RAF search and rescue pilot after completing an advanced helicopter training course. He's received his certificate from his father, Prince Charles, at a ceremony at RAF Shawbury in Shropshire. William's instructor, squadron leader Craig Finch, says the young prince has performed well.
I can safely say he's been one of the better students I've had. He's had no major problems throughout the course. There's certain areas he's had to work harder on than others, and that's the same for every student that goes through here.
Cricket and South Africa lead England by 35 runs after day two of the final test in Johannesburg. They finished on 215 for two, with captain Graham Smith scoring a century. And supermodel Claudia Schiffer is expecting her third child in May. She and her film director husband Matthew Vaughan are delighted by the news. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
This is Bristol Community 93.2 FM.
It's morning at the Jones House.
Morning, love.
Oh, another day of meetings.
Meanwhile, in the kitchen, younger brother James and Clive the dog head down to get their breakfast.
Phew, something smells down here. There's a horrible smell of gas down here, Mum. Don't flip the switch!
Mrs. Jones calls the National Gas Emergency Service line on 0800 111 999.
Hello, yes, I can smell gas in my house.
Okay, you can open up your doors and windows to allow some ventilation. Please do not switch on or off any electrical appliances. We will have an engineer with you very shortly.
Well done, James. I didn't know about that switch thingy.
We'll make a good team, don't we, Clive?
Smell gas? Don't risk it. Call free on 0800 111 999.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
There you go, folks. That's a lively country start to the next hour of the programme. That day, right there was the sound of Sarah Savoy and the Francadians with a Cajun track of hers called Gone sur le Grand Chemin, which I'm afraid I haven't got the French, but there you go. If you would like to hear more of that, I would suggest you get yourselves along to St. George's on Brandon Hill on Sunday the 24th of January at 3 p.m. Beware of that one. It's a 3 p.m. It's an afternoon concert. So you heard a little bit of that there. I'm going to stay in St. George's and tell you what you can go and see this week. This weekend, it's the Bristol Acoustic Music Festival. I will come back to that because I am going to play you out with a little piece of that. On Monday, that runs for Friday, Saturday and Sunday. I'm going up this evening. Tomorrow it starts at 2 p.m. and on Sunday it starts at 1 p.m. So there you go. On Monday evening, as part of the Bristol Festival of Ideas, Stuart Brand and Brian Eno are having a chat at 6 p.m. until 7 about the future of environmentalism. It's a strange, going to be a strange two-pronged attack. Stuart Brand is an American visionary who believes that living in the city is a greener thing to do, that nuclear fuel, nuclear energy is the solution to all of our problems, and that crop modification and genetic modification in crops is the answer to the food shortage. And Brian Eno thinks maybe slightly differently. So I think it's going to be a very, very interesting and illuminating evening. Tickets for that one, I'm afraid to say, are £6.50 and £4.50. Thursday, at 1 p.m, the Lunchtime Classics concerts are back. This will also cost you £6 or £8 if you're a fully-fledged grown-up. It's the soloists of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment, and they're having an investigation of some of Beethoven's works for ensemble. Schubert, the string trio in B-flat for violin, viola and cello. That's a very, very beautiful piece of music. And then there's the Beethoven septet for clarinet, bassoon, horn, violin, viola, cello and bass. These are interesting arrangements and not often played in public. So I would urge you to go along and see that. Then on Thursday, Migration starts back with Rupa and the April Fishes. This is at 8 p.m. You will have to pay £11 for this, I'm afraid. And I hadn't heard of these, but they're a very interesting bunch of people who kind of really reflect the globalised attitude to music. Led by singer and practising medical doctor Rupa Myra, San Francisco septet Rupa and the April Fishes play a wild and sexy multilingual amalgam of hot swing, French cafe music, Latin rhythms, tango and what Time Out has called global agitprop, as heard on their album Extraordinary Ordinary Rendition. The content of Rupa's lyrics reflects her background. Born to Punjabi parents in the Bay Area, she was sent back to India as a child before moving with her parents to Provence. And then back to the USA to study medicine. Not surprisingly, her songs deal with questions of racial identity and migration, which I think in the context of this programme is particularly important given the comments that were made earlier in the week by Denham saying that race is dead in the UK. It's all about class now. Now, before we leave St. George's, a week this evening, the Brodsky Quartet are playing Bartok, Stravinsky and Prokofiev. Very, very well worth getting along to see. And I'm giving you good advance warning for this. Saturday, the 23rd of January at 7:30 p.m, the Bristol Classical Players, who are one of the best amateur, is certainly probably in my opinion the best amateur orchestra in the city. Madeline Ridd is playing the cello and Tom Gautran is taking the baton. And Madeline Ridd is going to play the cello concerto in B minor by Dvorak for you and Brahms Symphony No. 2 in D. Get along to that. It is cheap. £7 for that one. Now, that's enough St. George's for now. We're going to move on to a nice little endeavour that's being put together in cahoots with Colston Hall and Bristol City Council. It's allformusic.co.uk, and it's a very good opportunity to learn. Well, it's New Year, so a lot of people think, do you know what, instead of giving something up this year, I'll take something up instead. And a lot of people are taking up new things. So there's a lot of good stuff going on. I would say this week, in fact, we've missed that one. Yes. This week you can start a course, a vocal course, learning to sing 70s and 80s. Chart the evolution of pop music, no experience is needed, and that's at St Monica's Trust in Westbury-on-Trim. And there's also a course in 90s and noughties music. That one is from the 18th of April. However, It runs every Monday from the 11th of January onwards, so you can just turn up. If you would like more information on this, I strongly recommend you log on to the website www.4music.co.uk. Right, that's enough of that. The Cube Cinema I'm going to touch on briefly. There's a midnight movie this evening, and it is Terry Gilliam's Brazil from 1985. It's 132 minutes long, and it will cost you the princely sum of £4, starring... what's his chops? Jonathan Pryce, who we recently saw in Bath. There we have it. Festival Ideas, I've already done. Now, free stuff. If you go down to the Arnold Feeney at the moment, there's a number of initiatives going on as part of the Reuse, Remake and Reclaim series that they're doing. Tomorrow, from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m, this is free. It's a civic inauguration of the Knitting Salon. The Knitting Salon travels to the ground floor of the Mall Bristol Broadmead Shopping Centre for its civic inauguration ahead of a UK tour. Share knitting skills and dialogue facilitated by the artists Trevor Pitt and Kate Pemberton. If you're a bit more of an outdoorsy type, on Sunday there's a tree planting party from 11 a.m. till 1 p.m. Up at Brandon Hill. Join Heath Bunting and Kyle Brandon for a food for free walk in Brandon Hill Park to learn about foraging, plant a tree and seasonal drinks and snacks. Meet at Great George Street entrance gates to the park off Park Street at 10:50 a.m. If you would like more information about this, I would urge you to go to bristol.gov.uk and follow the links to Brandon Hill on the It's part of the Parks and Open Spaces thing that they've got going. Now, back to theatre. If, as I'm sure some of you are, your beard is stroked by amateur dramatics, then opening tonight in Chipping Sodbury Town Hall, the Sodbury Players are presenting Jack and the Beanstalk by John Morley. If you would like to go and see this, it will cost you £7, and the box office number is 0845 126 0859. Now, going on, Colston Hall. I'm sorry, folks, I've got a stack of stuff to get through here. Next Thursday, the Slapstick Gala opens with Michael Palin on the 21st of January, Thursday the 21st. It's at 7:30 p.m. and I'm afraid to say tickets are £16 for this one. However, more interestingly for me, the Imagine Village are taking the hall on Saturday evening next week, the 23rd. The Imagine Village are a traditional music supergroup featuring Martin Carthy, Eliza Carthy and Chris Wood, amongst many, many others. That will also cost you some money, but not a huge amount. Now, again, I will point you in the direction of the classical industry ever at Colston Hall. Vladimir Ashkenazi, who is a man of massively advancing years and possibly one of the four cornerstones of classical music in the 20th century, is taking the baton with the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducting Stephen Ischlis, playing Elgar's Cello Concerto and Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony. I don't think we will ever see Ashkenazi in Bristol again after this concert, so I cannot recommend strongly enough that you go along. It's not cheap. Cheapest seats are £18. It goes up to £31, but it is one of your last opportunities to see a true legend. Now, I went to the theatre last night, and it's running Theatre Tarquini present Handel and the Darkening Moon. It's a beautifully heartfelt piece of work. I have to say, it took me maybe 15 minutes to tune into it. A bit like when you go and see Shakespeare, it takes you a little while to get the meter of the language. But it's performed by Paul Humpelitz, and it's a kind of a, I would say a biopic, but you can't use the word biopic when it's about theatre. It's dipping in and out of events from George Friedrich Handel's life, whom many will remember as the composer of Zadok the Priest, which is used in the royal inaugurations in this country, coronations, I beg your pardon, and also of the very famous Messiah chorus. So there you go. Mr. Humpelitz combines some of Handel's most beautiful music with poetic text and inventive imagery. Handel and the Darkening Moon takes an audience on a compelling journey full of unexpected twists and turns, culminating in a surprising and moving end. I rather liked it, and I have seen Paul Humpelitz's face before a lot of times. I just couldn't place him. You may have better luck with it. Now then, Comedy Box at the Hen and Chicken on North Street. Tony's gagging to get back into the studio, but I'm not going to let him. He's out the door now for the moment. Mark Thomas, whom I'm sure Tony will be aware for his politically agitating brand of comedy, he is on Wednesday and Thursday this week, and that is at the Comedy Box, Hen and Chicken. There we go. Now, I'm going to take a piece of music and then we're going to come back and do a little bit more What's On. This is the sound of... Who is it? Oh, I can't remember. Oh, it's Babel with a track called Disarm. Well, folks, that is the sound of Babel in a track of theirs called Disarm. If you would like to hear more of that, I suggest you get yourselves along to St. George's tomorrow because they are the headline act as part of the Bristol Acoustic Music Festival. They will be taking the stage at around 10:15 tomorrow evening. However, there are seven great acts before them tomorrow, including North Sea Navigator, Paul Garry, Q Fanfare, Bashima, Beth Porter, 3Kane Wales, Slow, Rachel Dadd and Ilya. Tonight you can go and see Hollowbody, The Wraith, The Cedar and Kid Carpet on Sunday. If the urge takes you and you haven't quite had enough acoustic music, you can start at 1:15pm with The Fawns, followed by Rosie Gard, Emily and the Whispers, Jacinda, Sweet Laredo, The Mandibles, Samantha Murray Band, Stanton Delaplane, Peppino and The Madness of King George to round out the whole weekend. It's going to be great. More about that on my show tomorrow morning between 10am and midday. As I mentioned before we took that piece of music, the Slapstick Festival starts next Thursday. The gala opening is with Michael Palin at the Colston Hall next Thursday evening. On Friday, the Italian Straw Hat with live accompaniment by Barbara Lentz is being shown at the Arnolfini, followed by Girl Shy, which I, in my opinion, is Harold Lloyd's funniest silent movie made in 1924. Then on Saturday, an awful lot of good fun stuff going. If you would like more information about this, log on to www.slapstick.org.uk. This year, they are paying particular attention to the input that Neil Innes has had on the comedy music scene over the last 40 years, and I think it's very much overdue. If you would like some Shakespeare before Shakespeare at the Tobacco Factory opens in 3 weeks' time, get yourselves along to the Redgrave, because the Bristol Old Vic Theatre School are presenting The Tempest by William Shakespeare. It's being directed by Toby Hulse and it opens on Saturday the 23rd, running until Saturday the 30th. If art that you hang on your wall is more your bag, then get yourselves up to the Royal West of England Academy, Urban Evolution, presented by Andrea Desmet of the RWA. She presents a broad range of images from one of the most eminent wood engravers at work today. This exhibition features work made in the last 10 years demonstrating Desmet's fascination with urban environment. The outstanding depictions of buildings and cities contain recurring themes of decay and renewal, which I think is appropriate to the conversation that you two are having beforehand about empty properties and the lack of council properties up and down the country.
Uh-oh.
Finally, before I bring you back in, there is also at the RWA Celebrating Paper. This runs until the 21st of February. Sculpture, screens and wall hang works are included in this unusual exhibition of artworks in handmade paper, card or recycled paper, including some nice Japanese stuff. Two last ones, I promise. The Eastern Community Choir are currently recruiting. They meet every Tuesday at 7:30 p.m. at the Eastern Community Centre. They sing easy-to-learn four-part harmony songs such as folk, pop, gospel and contemporary. Beginners are welcome and you can just come and sample it to see if you like it. There is a jam session with Cypher, at the Colston Hall Foyer this Saturday between 1 p.m. and 5 p.m. Go along. They do a lot of good stuff there. And finally, I'm going to plug this quite heavily on my show tomorrow because it's very local to me.
What time is your show, Billy?
Oh, between 10 a.m. and midday. Thank you for mentioning that, Tony. There are free writing workshops in Westbury-on-Trim starting on Tuesday, the 26th of January at the Westbury-on-Trim Church of England Primary School. And it is part of the Trading Local initiative, which premiered in Bedminster, I think, round about April, May time, with Show of Strength Theatre Company. It's a very interesting community initiative, getting local people to write locally sourced monologues, which are then performed by the professionals of Show of Strength Theatre Company in shops, so that the local people can go along. And basically it's an initiative to try and get people through the doors of the shops on their doorstep, as opposed to doing all the shopping in the supermarket.
And is the idea of keeping it local, is this one of your themes that runs through a lot of your... work you do on
After a fashion. I mean, our broadcast area is obviously through the medium of the internet. We are available worldwide, but you know, the immediate broadcast remit of BCFM is pretty local, and I agree with that, because since the demise of Summerfield, there isn't any major supermarket chains have their base even in the West Country, I don't think. So I think it's important to continually invest in the people on your doorstep and the contributors to the harmonious life that we all lead in the city.
On that theme, I wonder if you've been through the letters page in today's Evening Post.
No, I haven't.
Because
I can see you're looking at
I'm waving it around the studio now. You'll see that it's on page 11, which is the letters page in the Evening Post this evening. Time for some new ideas at Radio Anywhere. And the criticism here is that Radio Bristol could be, this is the BBC Radio Bristol, could be a station which someone could pick up anywhere. One of the emailers into the Evening Post, Dave Marks, has got quite a sort of diatribe, and there are several other letters here also making sort of complaints really about the changes that have been on Radio Bristol. Where we once had Roger Bennett, followed by Nigel Dando, Rachel Burden, who's now at Five Live, and Ben Prater, we then had the bumbling Richard Wyatt with the most pedestrian breakfast show ever. And now we have Steve Lefevre's chaotic effort, which is little more than less than hilarious banter between him and his near hysterical female assistants. Well, what they're saying essentially here is that there's not all that much really local about Bristol, and also that there aren't all that many local accents. And the criticism is really aimed at Tim Pemberton, who's the managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, since he took over, I think it was about 2 years ago, from Jenny Lacey. I wonder, are you both avid Radio Bristol listeners, Martin and Binny?
Personally, I do tune in occasionally, purely because, as far as I can see, they're the competition, so I need to monitor what their output is like. And I have to say, for the sort of work that I do on the Saturday show, between 10 a.m. and midday, it's now called the Bristol Arts Show, folks, so tune in. I have to say, I don't think they cover the arts within the city particularly well. I know it's a difficult and a broad brief, but they could, certainly in terms of the sport output, they, I think they have five or six sport commentators, and there's a whole sports department up there, and there isn't anybody at all for arts and culture, I don't think, that I can see.
Well, one of the problems, I think, I mean, I've worked in BBC local radio myself, and one of the problems is that you get a lot of information which is shoved under your nose, as the producers do anyway, comes in on email nowadays, but in those days there were record promoters and all sorts of things would be in the production office saying, what about this, what about this? And so for you to actually get proactive as a producer and go out and find material for yourself, the tendency is to be lazy and just let it roll in. I don't know what your thoughts are on that, Martin or Billy.
Martin?
Well, I haven't really got much of a comment to make about this.
I'm all for more of proactive production, that's what I think.
I think what is, and I don't, you know, you can quote me on this if you wish, I think Radio Bristol is going through a sort of a phase of transition, and they're not sure whether or not they want to be mandated by their audience, or if they're going to start making brave editorial decisions and investing in the producers that they've got up there. The one other final point I think is important to make here is that, strangely, a lot of people have quite modern radios in their cars now. And there's a little function on your car radio where you can hit a button and it tunes in automatically to Radio Bristol or whichever local radio station it is, just to give you the traffic updates. And I think, possibly, that one tiny piece of software could be the undoing of an awful lot of radio, local radio stations. I, as I mentioned, they cater quite well for sport up there. And the only other thing, really, I mean, you can see the weather by looking out the window. The only other service, I think, that is in much demand is the traffic. And now there's a button that can do it without you having to go through the dirge of listening to an awful lot of it.
Well, I can tell you that the motorways around Bristol right now are pretty much clear, because I've got Traffic England up on the computer here.
Yeah.
And so the motorways are pretty clear. I mean, usually the road from Gloucester down towards Cirencester is pretty busy. That's a bit slow, we can say that. But anyway, if you're on that road, you couldn't pick us up anyway. But no, certainly around Bristol, it's clear.
Yes, but apparently we have a lot of listeners in Bath who intend to listen to Radio 4. So apologies for that if you were hoping to get any mayor this evening, but as I was mentioning, that there's quite clever car radios in cars now, and they automatically retune. A lot of people coming out of Bath retune to us when they're trying to get Radio 4.
Another final thing on this. I don't know how many people remember the drama series, BBC drama series Shoestring.
Oh, yeah.
From the, I think it was the late 1980s.
Yes, Trevor Eve, down at Radio West.
That's right, they had Radio West. And Radio West was characterised a little bit like we see Radio Bristol being characterised here today in the Evening Post, as something that's a little bit staid, not very adventurous. And it's ironic, isn't it, that we've got a Radio Bristol which is being characterised just as it was set in the own BBC drama, as something which is a little bit too staid.
It's very strange.
Wasn't it Alan Partridge, Radio Norwich?
Yes.
That's your hero, isn't it, Tony?
Well, we've got Alan on the line as well. Alan, I wonder if you want to chip in on this discussion about BBC local radio. Are you
Can I tell you, just for the record, I started my broadcasting career by passing a board at BBC Radio Bristol when it was controlled by a rather good guy called Stuart White. And I was assigned to Southampton, where I began to learn about radio and television broadcasting. So I have, if you like, a spiritual tie with Bristol.
Have you got any thoughts about how to make a station really local and lively and adventurous?
Well, I would put two things together. I want to find a way to put new politics, to give new meaning to politics. And I would like to see local radio stations getting much more out into communities and having real debates and finding out what it is that people really want and what they will accept and what they will not object. It's a small way of helping to give some real life to democracy.
Okay, so anyway, that's our little discussion about Radio Bristol finished with. I don't know if you two in the studio have got any more to add, finally.
Well, I'm waiting for the phone to ring for them to offer me a job.
Okay.
Yes, I do understand Billy's got to be very careful about what he says here.
Well, we do have to be...
He's trying to get his foot in the door, I understand.
And, of course, their broadcast area is much, much wider than ours and in the evenings. And, of course, I think the other thing I was amazed to see that they may be stopping is this programme on late on a Saturday where they have all this kind of old-time music. I can't remember the name of the presenter. I don't know if you either people in the studio know. But they do have some very, very good stuff on. And it seems that...
Tim Pemberton is now thinking about cutting that. I think if people have got any thoughts of it on it, just get a copy of today's Evening Post, and all the contact details for the stations are in there if you want to make your views felt to the boss.
Yes, or if failing that, if you would like to make your views known to us, then please do email studio@bcfm.org.uk. If you feel there's part of the BBC remit that isn't being covered by them, then let us know and we'll see if we can make up for it.
Yes, we want to be slagged off in the Evening Post. Is that fair?
Okay, with that, we'll finish our little discussion. But now we're on to looking now a little bit more seriously at the Israel-Palestine conflict with Alan on the phone. And I'm joined, as I said, on the phone by Alan, who is, his name is Alan Hart, H-A-R-T, who is author of the two-volume book, Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews. Before he wrote the book, he was also a foreign correspondent for ITN and the BBC's Panorama programme. We British were the last colonial power in Israel-Palestine, handing over power to the Israeli Knesset in 1947. So we bear a great deal of responsibility for the mess that's happening there now. So we're going to start, though, with Marina Morris. And she's been out on the streets in the past week asking you what you think of Zionism. Zionism essentially is the sort of nationalistic Jewish movement which led to the creation of the State of Israel. But do ordinary people on the street actually know what Zionism is?
Richard Burden. Myself with the tribute.
Sorry, actually, that's the wrong clip there. And I think we're going to just go on to the next clip, which is clip number four. Martin, maybe in the meantime, whilst I'm sorting that out and getting the correct vox pop up, can you just talk about Zionism with Alan?
Well, it's a movement that began in the late 19th century, I believe, Alan. Can you hear?
Yeah.
Theodore Herzl founded the Zionist movement in the 1890s, and, you know, the aspirations towards a Jewish homeland. But, of course, they didn't have much influence within the Jewish community in that era. I mean, Jews tended to be involved in local politics wherever they happened to live.
OK, that'll do for the time being. I've actually managed to get our vox pop back again.
Tony, if this line goes down, don't panic. I'll reconnect immediately.
OK, now here's Marina Morris, as promised half a minute ago, with the vox pop on Zionism.
What do you think Zionism means?
Is it anything to do with, like, Zion as in Mormons' ideal world, idealism, something?
Well, Zion was the Mormons' place that they decided that's where God would be and that's the perfect world. So I don't know if it's anything connected to that, but if it's not, then I've no idea.
Don't know. No. Yes, it's to do with the Jewish faith. And now another name for the Jewish faith. It's probably to do with homeland and all that stuff as well.
Nationalist movement for the rebirth of the State of Israel.
Is Middle Eastern politics important to the UK?
It is if it's going to affect us going to war. And on our oil supplies, I think politics all over the world in general should be important to every other country, because it's all about the balance.
I think it's very important for our financial status and for everyday people, because we need to know how much the oil is going to cost and how much we're going to have to expend out. And we also need to know so we can keep our country's infrastructure secure. So yes, I think it's very important.
I think it's important to all governments, particularly the UK, yes.
As somebody said, God must have a sense of humour to put all that oil under all those Arabs. Yes.
OK, one of the most interesting comments I thought there is it's important for our financial status understanding the possible future cost of oil. What's your take on Zionism, Alan, if you can go right from the start, from Theodore Herzl? Because one of the things I find most curious about this is that even though Zionism is all about the Jewish right through the Bible to the promised land, Theodore Herzl himself was actually an atheist.
Tony, there is one key to understanding the Middle East and this conflict, and it's knowing, and you must allow me to give the key, it's knowing the difference between Judaism and Zionism. Judaism, briefly summarized, is the religion of Jews, not the Jews, because not all Jews are religious. And like Christianity and like Islam, Judaism has at its core a set of moral values and ethical principles. That's Judaism. Zionism is a sectarian colonial enterprise which created a state for some Jews in the Arab heartland, mainly by terrorism and ethnic cleansing 700,000 Palestinians from their homeland. And by so doing, Zionism made a complete mockery of the values and the moral principles of Judaism. Judaism and Zionism are total opposites. Now, very briefly, why is it important to know the difference? When you do know it, you can understand two things. Why it is perfectly possible to be anti-Zionist, anti-Zionism's colonial enterprise, without being in any way, shape, or form anti-Semitic, anti-Jew in the classic meaning of the term, but Arabs are also Semites, so if you're really anti-Semitic, you hate both Jews and Arabs. The other thing that you can then understand when you know this difference is why it is wrong to blame all Jews everywhere for the crimes of the hardcore Zionist few in Israel, which is not a Jewish state, it is a Zionist state. And I conclude this by saying, why the title of my book, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews? The sleeping giant of classical anti-Semitism, loathing of Jews, is being reawakened by Israel's behavior. And unless the Western world can be brought to understand the difference between Judaism and Zionism, it will ultimately, there will ultimately be another great turning against the Jew.
But surely the Zionists are have a right to national aspirations, just like any other national movement.
No, the Zionists claim that they were given their right by a UN partition plan resolution in 1947. What the world doesn't know until it reads my book is it was only a resolution of the General Assembly. The resolution was only got through on the narrowest of majority because the Zionist lobby persuaded four governments to change their minds and vote for the partition plan resolution.
But the narrow majority of the United Nations is a narrow majority, isn't it?
Hang on. The truth is, okay, it got the majority. But the truth is, what the General Assembly decides is only a recommendation. Nothing can become UN policy until it goes to the Security Council for approval. This did not go to the Security Council for approval because President Truman knew that if it was approved, given the strength of Arab and Muslim worldwide opposition to it, it could only be imposed by force. And President Truman was not prepared to use force. So the truth is that the partition resolution was vitiated, became invalid. What the Americans then did, they went back to the General Assembly to begin a new debate saying, what the hell can we do about Palestine and Zionism? It was while they were debating that that Israel unilaterally declared itself to be in existence, actually in defiance of the organized international community at the UN, including the Truman administration.
But surely at that point, Britain had pulled out. I mean, we were the colonial power and we pulled out. I mean, who can blame them for actually forming a government and getting organized?
Well, you say who can blame them. Is it right that they should take the land that did not belong to them and drive out 700,000 Palestinians by ethnic cleansing?
Tony's just pointed to me, and obviously it wasn't right. I'd like to also distinguish that there are different shades of Zionism. I mean, you've got Jabotinsky Zionism, which is sort of right-wing, very, very anti-Arab. And, of course, Zionism also had a left-wing face, the Israeli Labour Party, people like Golda Meir and so on, and they got a lot of support and credibility in liberal circles in the West because of the kind of guilt about what had happened in the Holocaust and so on and so forth. And we were speaking earlier about Yitzhak Rabin. He was a Labour politician in terms of Israeli politics. I think that the kind of line you're taking, Alan, could lead to the conclusion that the State of Israel shouldn't be there at all, and I think that's a legitimate point to have.
Well, that's true, but the fact is that it's there. It exists.
It is. I mean, I would compare it to the loyalist population in the six counties. I mean, in many respects, they were like outside settlers brought in to put down the local population.
I couldn't agree with you
But at the same time, you know, that's a long time ago, and they live there now. And to a certain extent, we've got to accept that the Jewish population in Palestine, Israel, is probably there to stay. But then the question is, how are we going to resolve the needs and values of all the other people that need to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I have no argument with the fact that Israel exists. I mean, it has always craved acceptance and recognition of the Palestinians for a very simple reason. The Israelis know full well, or their leaders do, that in international law, the only people who could legitimize the existence of the Zionist state are the Palestinians, nobody else. And that's why they've always demanded. Now, one of the great myths, there are two great myths. One is that poor little Israel has lived in danger of annihilation. That is simply not true. Israel's existence had never, ever been in danger, not in 48, not in 56, not in 67, not even in 1973. The other great myth is Israel has had no partners for peace. That is the most massive historical lie. As far back as their declaration of independence, King Abdullah of Jordan was seeking to make peace with them. More important, Egypt's President Nasser, that in our matter of record is documented, it's public, he was seeking an accommodation with Israel. He even had a secret dialogue with Israel's then foreign minister, Moshe Sharet, who became briefly prime minister.
But that's peace talks. That's just normal, Alan, surely.
No, but the point is, in Zionism's version of history, upon which the whole of Judeo-Christian history is premised, Israel has never had partners for peace. That's my point. I'm saying that's a lie.
Okay, so we have another clip now, and that is this is from the Dispatches programme that went out on UK's Channel 4. Was put together by Peter Oborne. And let's move forward a little bit and look at something called the Israel Lobby. Now, AIPAC in the United States is quite well known about, certainly over there, as a lobbying group for political parties in the United States. But what's not quite so well known is the Israel Lobby here in Britain. And here's a little clip from that programme, which went out late last year.
Tonight on Dispatches, how British policy is influenced by supporters of a foreign power.
Something became skewed in British politics when an unelected friend of the Prime Minister had so much influence.
Dispatches reveals the activities of the most effective lobby working inside British political parties.
The pro-Israeli lobby in this country is the most powerful political lobby. There's nothing to touch them.
We investigate the Israel lobby's bankrolling of British politicians.
I don't believe, and I don't think anybody else would believe, that these contributions come with no strings attached.
The Israeli invasion of Gaza caused huge controversy. A few months later, the Conservative Friends of Israel held its annual lunch for Conservative politicians and businessmen. This year, the star speaker was David Cameron. I was astonished to note that he made no reference to the widespread killing of innocent civilians and massive destruction in Gaza 6 months earlier. Indeed, Cameron went out of his way to praise Israel because, so he said, it strives to protect innocent life. He said, if I become Prime Minister, Israel has a friend who will never turn his back on Israel. I resolved to ask questions. How does the pro-Israel lobby in Britain work? Who runs it? And how does it get results? What's clear is that support for Israel is a powerful presence in all the main parties. Look at this recent exchange in the House of Commons when David Amos, Secretary of the Conservative Friends of Israel, asked what the government was doing to improve British relations with Israel. Ivan Lewis, the Foreign Office Minister who had been deputy chair of the Labour Friends of Israel, replied.
Israel is a close ally of the UK, and we have regular, warm and productive exchanges at all levels. We shall continue to foster a close relationship with Israel.
Well, that was just a brief extract from the beginning of a Dispatches documentary by Peter Oborne, who usually is a columnist in the Daily Mail, from late last year. Can you tell us, Alan, what your knowledge is of the various of the strength, the power of the Israeli lobby in Westminster?
Well, first of all, there's one correction that has to be made. The flaw with that programme is the same as the flaw in the book by Mersham and Walt on the Israel lobby in America. It's not an Israel lobby. That would imply that it speaks for all Israelis, and it doesn't. It's a Likud lobby, more properly defined as a Zionist lobby. And the man who first put that to me was Shimon Peres. At the time, he was the leader of the opposition to Begin's government, and I was actually the secret link man in an exploratory conversation between Peres and Arafat. And Peres said to me, our problem is that it's not an Israel lobby, it's a Likud lobby. But the lobby system is, you know, it needs its own two or three sentences of explanation. In America, you cannot run for Congress or even the White House without certainly organized Jewish lobby, Zionist lobby funding. And in tight election races, there are six constituencies where the Jewish vote can make or break you. The delivery of the organized Jewish vote. The power of the Zionist lobby, its control over Congress, is enormous. Now, what has happened in Britain, particularly in the last decade or so, is that same money influence has come into British politics. It really is an enormously powerful lobby.
But surely the Arabs, Alan, also have their lobby too.
Look, the Arabs, I am, if you like, anti-Zionist in my book. I am passionately anti the Arab regimes and elite. The truth about them is that when Israel succeeded in establishing its state, its fait accompli in 48-49, the Arab regimes shared the same hope as Zionists as the major Western powers. They wanted the Palestine file to remain closed forever because they knew that if it was ever reopened, there would at some point have to be a confrontation with Zionism, which ultimately meant a confrontation with the West. The leaderships in the Arab world are incompetent as well as corrupt and repressive, and they have effectively washed their hands of the Palestinians.
Well, obviously, I agree with all of that. I mean, certainly the Labour Party, Lord Levy was Blair's main money man and also very close to the Israeli government. And, of course, what Blair's been trying to do with the Labour Party over the last 10, 15 years is break the financial tie with the trade union movement and to find other sponsors for new Labour policies. And Lord Levy has been a very important character in the fundraising for the Labour Party.
Martin, of course, you're absolutely right, but he was actually very clever. You're right, Tony Blair came in wanting to break the money hold that the trade unions had on the Labour Party, so he did turn to Lord Levy. And Lord Levy raised the first 80 or 90 million for Blair. But then Levy said to himself, oh, I must be a bit cleverer than this. And then he found half a dozen Muslim wealthy stooges,
yep,
who in return for promises of knighthoods and a place in the House of Lords would donate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, this raises the question of money in politics to court. You know, I mean, it's not just Israeli money that's poisoning politics. It's the wellspring of a lot of the corruption in our political system in Britain and elsewhere, wherever the money comes from.
Do you
solve this problem?
Do you think that's why many of the European countries they do state funding of political parties?
Well, that's,
I mean, I personally would like to see state funding of political parties and nothing else. That would restrict the budget. you know, 20 million for each election or whatever. But what it would mean is that they would not be able to have all these rich advertisements on television and radio and newspapers. They'd have to do what politicians did when I was a kid and a teenager. They'd have to come out to the sticks and the dresses.
Yeah, I mean, in Scandinavian countries, it's been standard practice since World War II that all political parties are funded by the state, and that reduces the amount of money involved and levels the playing field. But if the British public have been brainwashed into the idea that, oh, we're not paying for politicians, but if you don't pay for politicians, somebody else will, and who pays the piper calls the tune.
Back in April last year, that's April 2009, it was the 60th anniversary of the founding of the State of Israel. And President Obama made a speech all about it. And we have this is about 2 minutes of that speech now.
This is a time for Israelis, for Jews, and for all friends of Israel to celebrate the realization of a dream and to rededicate ourselves to uplifting the promise of Israel's independence. You know, a few years ago, in the winter of 2006, I had the great privilege of traveling to the Holy Land. And as all of you know, it's a place unlike any on earth, a place filled with history, a place filled with promise, a place that's known moments of terrible darkness, but also extraordinary joy. One of the most joyful moments came 60 years ago this week, when the Jewish State of Israel declared independence. While that day marked a new beginning, it also concluded a journey unlike any in the history of the world. It's a journey that dates back to Moses leading his people towards the promised land, a journey that included centuries of hope for the Jewish people when their dream of a homeland was darkest, a journey that gained new meaning through the work of Zionist leaders like Theodore Herzl, and a new urgency after the terrible suffering and loss of the Holocaust. And it was a dream no longer deferred when David Ben-Gurion declared Israel's independence 60 years ago this week. The end of this journey was not the end of the challenges facing Israel. The fight for independence and the fight for the survival of a Jewish state has endured through decades of war and of terror. To this very day, the people of Israel show their uncommon courage and commitment to freedom every time they board a bus or kiss their children goodbye. But through these challenges to their state's existence, Israelis have done more than survive. They have forged a brilliant and strong democracy. They've provided a promised land for Jews from around the world. They've built a thriving economy that has spread opportunity to Israeli citizens while enriching the world. And they've developed a rich cultural life and made enormous contributions to the sciences and the arts. Israel's also developed many friendships, and none is deeper than the bond between the people of Israel and the people of the United States. It's a bond rooted in the millions of Jewish immigrants. It's a bond rooted in the millions of Jewish immigrants who sought opportunity on America's shores, in the liberation of those awful Nazi death camps in World War II, and in the courageous stance of an American president 60 years ago this week. It was not a foregone conclusion that Harry Truman would recognize Israel. Senior members of his own government counseled him not to, and many other countries would be slow in embracing the young Jewish state. But Truman stood on principle. He recognized that America shared fundamental values with this new democracy, and that Israel's independence was hard-earned. He would later write that he believed a solemn promise had been made to an oppressed people, and he refused to stand in the way of the hopes and the dreams of the Jewish people. And so minutes after David Ben-Gurion made his announcement, President Truman made the United States the first nation to recognize Israel, and our abiding friendship was born.
So that was Barack Obama speaking in the middle of last year on the occasion of the 60th anniversary of Israel. He mentioned this David Ben-Gurion, Alan. Can you tell us who David Ben-Gurion actually was?
Yeah. David Ben-Gurion was an immigrant from Poland, and he was the founding father of Israel. But we haven't got much time left, so I want to say this. there's a reality in America that has to be acknowledged by anybody who's interested in peace. No American president is ever going to be free to apply the necessary pressure for Israel to be serious about peace because of the Zionist lobby's stranglehold on Congress, unless and until there is a constituency of understanding in the people of America. Only that is going to create the space for an American president to take on the Zionist lobby in Congress. And at the moment, there's no sign of that happening. There are two views of Obama. One is that he is a well-managed instrument of Zionism. I'm not sure I buy that. I think more to the point is that he's a great speaker, inspirational even, but he's very inexperienced. And I think when he went into the White House, he truly had no idea of the real power of the Zionist lobby as it relates to American policy making for the Middle East.
Well, we've got just only 5 minutes left. Let's spend that looking at the prospects for peace. Martin, let's come to you. What are your thoughts about some of the more potentially successful avenues for actually getting real peace? Because one of the things I can remember hearing about since I was this big, a child, is that there is a peace process in the Middle East, but this peace process never seems to really lead anywhere.
Well, it's not going to lead anywhere as long as the Israelis aren't under sufficient pressure from the US to deliver what's required, as Alan has pointed out. I think we do need an education program to get people to understand that the Israelis are not necessarily in the right just because they say they are. But if we're going to have a war on terror and send our troops to Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, wherever it is we're going to send them, that's a whole other big issue. We really can't afford to have the Israelis making mess in the Middle East and undermining British troops as they're being put on the ground in Muslim countries.
So you're saying it's just Western pressure? That's the only thing?
When Obama mentioned in his little speech there how economically successful Israel had been, Israel is a great big welfare case. Every citizen of Israel is in receipt of thousands of dollars of taxpayer subsidy every year from the United States of America. If that subsidy was withdrawn, or even threats were made to withdraw it, I saw that George Mitchell suggested that loans might not be rolled over, and immediately the Israeli press went bonkers. But of course, the US government could cut off Israel's money supply just like that, and then they might be more reasonable.
Alan, let's leave the final word to you. What are your thoughts about the most successful potential avenue to peace?
I don't see one at the moment. And I think the real problem is this, and it's the truth about why Israel possesses nuclear weapons. And I had this conversation privately, I have to say, at the time with Moshe Dayan, Israel's one-eyed warlord, years ago. I said to him, Moshe, you don't need nuclear weapons vis-a-vis the Arabs. You can beat them any day of the week you like with both hands tied behind your back. Why have you got them? And he said more or less the following. Ben Gurion was not stupid. I'm not stupid. We know how the real world of politics works. We know that the day will come when even our best friends, he meant America, will say to us, thank you, Israel, you've served your purpose. You're now more of a liability than not. You must do this. And we shall say, Mr. President, don't push us further than we are prepared to go because we could use these things. And on page 3 of my book, I quote Golda Meir when she was Prime Minister in a conversation I did with her, Panorama. And at a point, I said to her, excuse me, Prime Minister, I want to make sure I understand what you're saying. You are saying that if ever Israel was in danger of being defeated, you would be prepared to take the region and the whole world down with you. Without a pause, Golda said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. That program went out at 8 o'clock on a Monday evening. By 10 o'clock, the Times of London had changed its lead editorial, quoted what Golda had said to me, and added its own opinion, we had better believe her.
Well, Alan, thank you ever so much for joining us this evening. That's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2, where we review the week's news and discuss some of the big stories in Bristol, Britain and around the world. If you want a story discussed, have questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a topic or guest for a future show, please email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. This week's guest, Alan Hart, is author of Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews. And also he has a blog on the internet, so you can just look that up at alanhart.net. Thanks very much to this week's guest, Alan Hart, our resident Old Labour pundit too, Martin Summers, and to Marina Morris for this week's Vox Pop on Zionism. Next week at 5, we'll be doing it all again, and helping us dissect the week's news will be the Labour leader on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Up next is Somali language programming with Nemo and Somali Youth. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing weekend.
You are listening to BCFM 93.2.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol. It is run by volunteers and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.